Preserve, 20 miles southwest of Chicago, Arthur and Betty Compton found an isolated, scenic site for the Pyle Building, a terminal moraine forested with hawthorn and scrub oak known as the Argonne Forest. The Army's Nichols negotiated with the county to use the land. Stone and Webster began planning construction. The Fermis rented a house from a businessman moving to Washington for war work. Since they were enemy aliens and not allowed to own a shortwave radio, the man had to have his big all-band Cape Heart temporarily disabled of its long-distance frequencies, though it continued to supply dance music to the party room on the third floor. Fermi was angry to find his mail being opened and complained indignantly until the practice was stopped, or managed more surreptitiously. The Comptons gave a series of parties to welcome newcomers to the Met Lab. At each of these parties, Laura Fermi writes, the English film Next of Kin was shown. It depicted in dark tones consequences of negligence and carelessness. A briefcase laid down on the floor in a public place is stolen by a spy. English military plans become known to the enemy. Bombardments, destruction of civilian homes, and an unnecessarily high toll of lives on the fighting front are the result. Willingly, we accepted the hint and confined our social activities to the group of metallurgists. Compton, who described himself as one of those who must talk over important problems with his wife, arranged uniquely to have Betty Compton cleared. None of the other wives was supposed to know about her husband's work. Laura Fermi found out, like many others, only at the end of the war. In mid-August, Fermi's group could report a probable K for a graphite uranium oxide pile of close to 1.04. They were working on control rod design and testing the vacuum properties of both metal sheet and balloon cloth. The cloth was Anderson's idea, a possible alternative to canning the pile to exclude neutron-absorbing air. It proved serviceable, and Anderson followed up. For the balloon cloth enclosure, I went to the Goodyear Rubber Company in Akron, Ohio. The company had a good deal of experience in building blimps and rubber rafts, but a square balloon, 25 feet on a side, seemed a bit odd to them. They made it anyway, with no questions asked. It should be good for a 1% improvement in K. Between September 15th and November 15th, Anderson, Walter Zinn, and their crews also built 16 successive exponential piles in the Stagg Field West Stands to measure the purity of the various shipments of graphite, uranium oxide, and metal they had begun to receive in quantity. Not all the uranium was acceptable. But Mallinckrodt Chemical Works in St. Louis, specialists at handling the ether necessary for oxide extraction, began producing highly purified brown oxide at the rate of 30 tons a month. And the National Carbon Company and a smaller supplier, by using purified petroleum coke for raw material and doubling furnace time, significantly improved graphite supplies. Graphite is molded as coke, then baked in a high-temperature electric arc oven for long hours until it crystallizes and its impurities vaporize away. By September, regular deliveries began to arrive in covered trucks. Physicists doubled as laborers to unload the bricks and cans and pass them into the West Stands for finishing. Walter Zinn took charge of preparing the materials for the pile. The graphite came in from various manufacturers as rough 4.25-inch bars in 17 to 50-inch lengths. So that the bars would fit closely together, they had to be smoothed and cut to standard 16.5-inch lengths. About a fourth of them also had to be drilled for the lumps of uranium they would hold. A few required slots machined through to make channels for control rods. The uranium oxide needed to be compressed into what the physicists called pseudospheres, stubby cylinders with round-shouldered ends, for which purpose the press from the Jersey City junkyard had been shipped to Chicago the previous winter. For crew, Zinn had half a dozen physicists, a thoroughly able carpenter, and some 30 high school dropouts earning pocket money until their draft notices came through. They were back-of-the-yards boys from the tough neighborhood beyond the Chicago stockyards, and Zinn improved the fluency of his swearing, keeping them in line. Machining the graphite was like sharpening thousands of giant pencils. Zinn used power woodworking tools. A jointer first made two sides of each graphite brick perpendicular and smooth. A planer finished the other two surfaces. A swing saw cut the bricks to length. That processing produced 14 tons of bricks a day. Each brick weighed 19 pounds. To drill the blind, round-bottomed 3.25-inch holes for the uranium pseudospheres, 2 to a brick, Zinn adapted a heavy lathe. He mounted a 3.25-inch spade bit into the headstock of the lathe, where the material to be turned would normally be mounted, and forced the graphite up against the tool with the lathe carriage. Dull bits caused problems. Zinn tried tough carballoy bits first, but they were tedious to resharpen. He began making bits from old steel files, sharpening them by hand whenever they dulled. One sharpening was good for 60 holes, about an hour's work. Before they were through, they would shape and finish 45,000 graphite bricks and drill 19,000 holes. General Groves made his first appearance at the Met Lab on October 5th and delivered his first pronouncement. The Technical Council was debating cooling systems again. "The War Department considers the project important," Seabarg paraphrases Groves' formula, which they would all learn by heart. "There is no objection to a wrong decision with quick results. If there is a choice between two methods, one of which is good and the other looks promising, then build both. Get the cooling system decision into Compton's hands by Saturday night," Groves demanded. It was Monday. They had been debating for months. Groves moved on to Berkeley more impressed with their work than his Met Lab auditors realized. "I left Chicago feeling that the plutonium process seemed to offer us the greatest chances for success in producing bomb material," he recalls. "Every other process depended upon the physical separation of materials having almost infinitesimal differences in their physical properties. Transmutation by chain reaction was entirely new. But the rest of the plutonium process, chemical separation, while extremely difficult and completely unprecedented, did not seem to be impossible." At the beginning of the month, to Compton's great relief, the Brigadier had convinced E.I. DuPont de Nemours, the Delaware chemical and explosives manufacturers, to take over building and running the plutonium production piles under subcontract to Stone and Webster. He meant to involve the industrial chemists more extensively than that, meant for them to take over the plutonium project in its entirety. DuPont resisted the increasing encroachment. "Its reasons were sound," writes Groves. "The evident physical operating hazards, the company's inexperience in the field of nuclear physics, the many doubts about the feasibility of the process, the paucity of proven theory, and the complete lack of essential technical design data." DuPont also suspected, once it had sent an 8-man review team to Chicago at the beginning of November, that the plutonium project was the least promising of the several then under development, and might even fail, tarnishing the company's reputation. Nor was it happy at the prospect of identifying itself with a secret weapon of mass destruction. It still remembered the general condemnation it had received for selling munitions to Britain and France before the United States entered the First World War. Groves told the DuPont Executive Committee that the Germans were probably hard at work, and the only defense against a Nazi atomic bomb would be an American bomb, and added what he took to be a clinching argument. "If we were successful in time, we would shorten the war, and thus save tens of thousands of American casualties." The second week in November, DuPont admitted the possibility of regular production by 1945 and accepted the assignment, limiting itself to a profit of $1 to avoid arms merchant stigma, but made its skepticism and reluctance clear. By then, Stone and Webster's construction workers had gone on strike. The pile building, scheduled for completion by October 20th, would be indefinitely delayed. Fermi lived with the problem only long enough to recalculate the risks of pile control. In early November, he cornered Compton in his office and proposed an alternative site, the double squash court, where his team had built its series of exponential piles. A K greater than 1 presented an entirely different order of risk from a K of less than 1, however. Compton had, in Seaborg's words, a dreadful decision to make. We did not see how a true nuclear explosion, such as that of an atomic bomb, could possibly occur. Compton writes with more calm than he probably felt at the time. But the amount of potentially radioactive material present in the pile would be enormous, and anything that would cause excessive ionizing radiation in such a location would be intolerable. He asked for Fermi's analysis of the probability of control. No doubt Fermi discussed the various hand and automatic control rods he planned for the pile. But even slow neutron fission generations had been calculated to multiply in thousandths of a second, which might flash the pile to dangerous levels of heat and radiation before any merely mechanical control system could move into position. The most significant fact assuring us that the chain reaction could be controlled, says Compton, was one of the Richard Roberts team's earliest discoveries at the Carnegie Institution's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism, following Bohr's announcement of the discovery of fission in 1939. In Compton's words, that a certain small fraction of the neutrons associated with the fission process are not emitted at once, but come off a few seconds after fission occurs. With a pile operating at K only marginally above 1, such delayed neutrons would slow the response sufficiently to allow time for adjustment. For once, Compton made a quick decision. With control seemingly assured, he allowed Fermi to build CP1 in the West Stands. He chose not to inform the president of the University of Chicago, Robert Maynard Hutchins, reasoning that he should not ask a lawyer to judge a matter of nuclear physics. The only answer he could have given would have been no, and this answer would have been wrong. So I assume the responsibility myself. The word meltdown had not yet entered the reactor engineer's vocabulary. Fermi was only then inventing that specialty. But that is what Compton was risking. A small Chernobyl in the midst of a crowded city. Except that Fermi, as he knew, was a formidably competent engineer. In mid-November, Fermi reorganized his team into 2 12-hour shifts, a day crew under Walter Zinn, who continued to supervise materials production as well, a night crew under Herbert Anderson. Construction began on Monday morning, November 16, 1942. From the balcony of the double squash court in the West Stands of Stagg Field, Fermi directed the hanging of the cubical, dark-gray Goodyear balloon, as his men hauled it into place with block and tackle. It dominated the room, bottom panel smoothed on the floor, top and three sides secured to the ceiling and the walls, the fourth side facing the balcony furled up out of the way like an awning. Someone drew a circle on the floor panel to locate the first layer of graphite, and without ceremony the crew began positioning the dark, slippery bricks. The first layer was dead graphite that carried no load of uranium. Solid crystalline carbon to diffuse and slow the neutrons that fission would generate. Up the pile as it stacked, the crews would alternate one layer of dead graphite with two layers of bricks, each drilled and loaded with 2 5-pound uranium pseudospheres. That created a cubic cell of neutron-diffusing graphite around every lump of uranium. To build the wooden framing, Herbert Anderson recalls, Gus Knuth, the millwright, would be called in. We would show him what we wanted. He would take a few measurements, and soon the timbers would be in place. There were no detailed plans or blueprints for the frame or the pile. Since they had batches of graphite, oxide, and metal of varying purity, they improvised the placement of materials as they went along. Fermi, says Anderson, spent a good deal of time calculating the most effective location for the various grades of material on hand. They were soon averaging not quite 2 layers a shift, handing the bricks along from their delivery skids, sliding them to the workers on the pile, singing together to pass the time. The bricks in the dead graphite layers alternated direction, three running east and west, and the next three north and south. That gave support to the oxide layers, which all ran together from front to back except at the outer edges, where dead graphite formed an outer shell. The physicist bricklayers had to be careful to line up the slots for the 10 control rod channels that passed at widely distributed points completely through the pile. A simple design for a control rod was developed, says Anderson, which could be made on the spot, cadmium sheet nailed to a flat wood strip. The 13-foot strips had to be inserted and removed by hand. Except when the reactivity of the pile was being measured, they were kept inside the pile and locked using a simple hasp and padlock, the only keys to which were kept by Zinn and myself. Cadmium, which has a gargantuan absorption cross-section for slow neutrons, held the pile quiescent. As it grew, they assembled wooden scaffolding to stand on and ran loads of bricks up to the working face on a portable materials elevator. Before the arrival of the elevator, during the period when they were building large exponential piles, they had simply leaned over from the precarious 2x12-inch scaffolding and reached the bricks up from the men on the floor below. Groves walked in on them one day and dressed them down for risking their necks. The elevator appeared unbidden soon after. When they achieved the 15th layer, Zinn and Anderson began measuring neutron intensity at the end of each shift at a fixed point near the center of the pile with the control rods removed. They used a boron trifluoride counter Leona Woods had devised that worked much like a Geiger counter, clicking off the neutron count. Standard indium foils bombarded to radioactivity by pile neutrons gave daily checks on the boron counter's calibration. Fermi had complained to Segre in October that he was doing physics by telephone. Now he moved a little closer to the work. "Each day we would report on the progress of the construction to Fermi," Anderson notes, usually in his office in Eckerd Hall. "Then we would present our sketch of the layers that we had assembled and reach some agreement on what would be added during the following shifts." Fermi took the raw boron counter and indium measurements and calculated a countdown. As the pile approached its slow neutron critical mass, the neutrons generated within it by spontaneous fission multiplied through more and more generations before they were absorbed. At K equals 0.99, for example, each neutron would multiply through an average 100 generations before its chain of generations died out. Fermi divided the square of the radius of the pile by a measure of the intensity of radioactivity the pile induced in indium, and got a number that would decrease to zero as the pile approached criticality. At layer 15, the countdown stood at 390. At layer 19, it dropped to 320. It was 270 at layer 25 and down to 149 at layer 36. As winter locked down, the unheated west stands turned bitterly cold. Graphite dust blackened walls, floors, hallways, lab coats, faces, hands. A black haze dispersed light in the floodlit air. White teeth shone. Every surface was slippery, hands and feet routine casualties of dropped blocks. The men building the pile, lifting tons of materials every shift, stayed warm enough, but the unlucky security guards stationed at doors and entrances froze. Zinn scavenged rakish makeshift to thaw them out. "We tried charcoal fires and empty oil drums. Too much smoke. Then we secured a number of ornamental, imitation log gas-fired fireplaces. These were hooked up to the gas mains, but they gobbled up the oxygen and replaced it with fumes, which burned the eyes. The University of Chicago came to the rescue. Years before, big league football had been banned from the campus. We found in an old locker a supply of raccoon fur coats. Thus, for a time, we had the best-dressed collegiate-style guards in the business." Fermi had originally designed his first full-scale pile as a 76-layer sphere. Some 250 tons of better graphite from National Carbon now promised to reduce neutron absorption below previous estimates, more than 6 tons of high-purity uranium metal in the form of 2.25-inch cylinders began arriving from Iowa State College at Ames, where one of the MetLab's chemistry group leaders, Frank Spedding, had converted a laboratory to backyard mass production. Spedding's eggs, dropped in place of oxide pseudospheres into drilled graphite blocks that were then stacked in spherical configuration close to the center of the CP1 lattice, significantly increased the value of K. Adjusting for the improvements, Fermi saw that they would not need to seal the Goodyear balloon and evacuate the air from the pile and could eliminate some 20 layers. His countdown should converge to zero, K equals 1.0, between layers 56 and 57. Instead of a sphere, the pile would take the form of a doorknob as big as a two-car garage, a flattened rotational ellipsoid 25 feet wide at the equator and 20 feet high from pole to pole. Anderson's crew assembled this final configuration on the night of December 1st. That night, the construction proceeded as usual, with all cadmium-covered wood in place. When the 57th layer was completed, I called a halt to the work, in accordance with the agreement we had reached in the meeting with Fermi that afternoon. All the cadmium rods but one were removed, and the neutron count taken following the standard procedure which had been followed on the previous days. It was clear from the count that once the only remaining cadmium rod was removed, the pile would go critical. I resisted great temptation to pull the final cadmium strip and be the first to make a pile chain react. However, Fermi had foreseen this temptation and extracted a promise from me to make the measurement, record the result, insert all the cadmium rods, and lock them all in place. Which Anderson dutifully did, and closed up the squash court, and went home to bed. The pile, as it waited in the dark cold of Chicago winter to be released to the breeding of neutrons and plutonium, contained 771,000 pounds of graphite, 80,590 pounds of uranium oxide, and 12,400 pounds of uranium metal. It cost about $1 million to produce and build. Its only visible moving parts were its various control rods. If Fermi had planned it for power production, he would have shielded it behind concrete or steel and pumped away the heat of fission with helium or water or bismuth to drive turbines to generate electricity. But CP1 was simply and entirely a physics experiment designed to prove the chain reaction, unshielded and uncooled, and Fermi intended, assuming he could control it, to run it no hotter than half a watt, hardly enough energy to light a flashlight bulb. He had controlled it day by day for 17 days of its building as its K approached 1.0, matching its responses with his estimates, and he was confident he could control it when its chain reaction finally diverged. What would he do if he was wrong? One of his young colleagues asked him. He thought of the dampening effect of delayed neutrons. I will walk away. Leisurely, he answered. The next morning, Leona Woods remembers, the beginning of the fateful day, December 2, 1942. It was terribly cold, below zero. Fermi and I crunched over to the stands in creaking, blue-shadowed snow and repeated Herb's flux measurement with the standard boron trifluoride counter. Fermi had plotted a graph of his countdown numbers. The new data point fell exactly on the line he had extrapolated from previous measurements, a little shy of layer 57. Fermi discussed a schedule for the day with Zinn and Volney Wilson, Woods continues. Then, a sleepy Herb Anderson showed up. Herb, Fermi, and I went over to the apartment I shared with my sister. It was close to the stands, for something to eat. I made pancakes, mixing the batter so fast that there were bubbles of dry flour in it. When fried, these were somewhat crunchy between the teeth, and Herb thought I had put nuts in the batter. Outside was raw wind. On the second day of gasoline rationing, Chicagoans jammed streetcars and elevated trains, leaving almost half their usual traffic of automobiles at home. The State Department had announced that morning that 2 million Jews had perished in Europe, and 5 million more were in danger. The Germans were preparing a counterattack in North Africa. American Marines and Japanese soldiers struggled in the hell of Guadalcanal. Back we mushed through the cold, creaking snow. 57th Street was strangely empty. Inside the hall of the West Stands, it was as cold as outside. We put on the usual gray, now black with graphite, laboratory coats, and entered the double squash court, containing the looming pile, enclosed in the dirty, grayish-black balloon cloth, and then went up on the spectators' balcony. The balcony was originally meant for people to watch squash players, but now it was filled with control equipment and readout circuits, glowing and winking and radiating some gratefully received heat. The instrumentation included redundant boron trifluoride counters for lower neutron intensities and ionization chambers for higher. A wooden pier extending out from the face of the pile supported automatic control rods operated by small electric motors that would stand idle that day. Zip, a weighted safety rod Zinn had designed, rode the same scaffolding. A solenoid-actuated clutch controlled by an ionization chamber held Zip in position withdrawn from the pile. If neutron intensity exceeded the chamber setting, the solenoid would trip, and gravity would pull the rod into position to stop the chain reaction. Another Zip-like rod had been tied to the balcony railing with a length of rope. One of the physicists, feeling foolish, would stand by to chop the rope with an axe if all else failed. Allison had even insisted on a suicide squad. 3 young physicists installed with jugs of cadmium sulfate solution near the ceiling on the elevator they had used to lift graphite bricks. Several of us, Wattenberg complains, were very upset with this, since an accidental breakage of the jugs near the pile could well have destroyed the usefulness of the material. George Weil, a young veteran of the Columbia days, took up position on the floor of the squash court to operate one of the cadmium control rods by hand at Fermi's order. Fermi had scalars that counted off boron trifluoride readings with loud clicks, and a cylindrical pen recorder that performed a similar function silently, graphing pile intensities in ink on a roll of slowly rotating graph paper. For calculations, he relied on his own trusted 6-inch slide rule, the pocket calculator of its day. Around mid-morning, Fermi began the crucial experiment. First, he ordered all but the last cadmium rod removed and checked to see if the neutron intensity matched the measurement Anderson had made the night before. With that first comparison, Volney Wilson's team, working on the balcony, took time to adjust its monitors. Fermi had calculated in advance the intensity he expected the pile to reach at each step of the way, as George Weil withdrew the last 13-foot cadmium rod by measured increments. When Wilson's team was ready, writes Wattenberg, Fermi instructed Weil to move the cadmium rod to a position which was about halfway out. The adjustment brought the pile to well below critical condition. The intensity rose, the scalars increased their rates of clicking for a short while, and then the rate became steady, as it was supposed to. Fermi busied himself at his slide rule, calculating the rate of increase, and noted the numbers on the back. He called to Weil to move the rod out another 6 inches. Again, the neutron intensity increased and leveled off. The pile was still subcritical. Fermi had again been busy with his little slide rule and seemed very pleased with the results of his calculations. Every time the intensity leveled off, it was at the values he had anticipated for the position of the control rod. The slow, careful checking continued through the morning. A crowd began to gather on the balcony. Szilard arrived, Wigner, Allison, Spedding, whose metal eggs had flattened the pile. 25 or 30 people accumulated on the balcony watching, most of them the young physicists who had done the work. No one photographed the scene, but most of the spectators probably wore suits and ties in the genteel tradition of pre-war physics, and since it was cold in the squash court near zero, they would have kept warm in coats and hats, scarves and gloves. The room was dingy with graphite dust. Fermi was calm, the pile rising before them. Faced with raw 4-by-6-inch pine timbers up to its equator, domed bare graphite above, looked like an ominous black beehive in a bright box. Neutrons were its bees, dancing and hot. Fermi called for another 6-inch withdrawal. Weil reached up to comply. The neutron intensity leveled off at a rate outside the range of some of the instruments. Time passed, says Wattenberg, the watchers abiding in the cold, while Wilson's team again adjusted the electronics. After the instrumentation was reset, Fermi told Weil to remove the rod another 6 inches. The pile was still subcritical. The intensity was increasing slowly, when suddenly there was a very loud crash. The safety rod, Zip, had been automatically released. Its relay had been activated by an ionization chamber because the intensity had exceeded the arbitrary level at which it had been set. It was 11:30 a.m., and Fermi said, "I'm hungry. Let's go to lunch." The other rods were put into the pile and locked. At 2 in the afternoon, they prepared to continue the experiment. Compton joined them. He brought along Crawford Greenwalt, the tall, handsome engineer, who was the leader of the DuPont contingent in Chicago. 42 people now occupied the squash court, most of them crowded onto the balcony. Fermi ordered all but one of the cadmium rods again unlocked and removed. He asked Weil to set the last rod at one of the earlier morning settings and compared pile intensity to the earlier reading. When the measurements checked, he directed Weil to remove the rod to the last setting before lunch, about 7 feet out. The closer K approached 1.0, the slower the rate of change of pile intensity. Fermi made another calculation. The pile was nearly critical. He asked that Zip be slid in. That adjustment brought the neutron count down. "This time," he told Weil, "take the control rod out 12 inches. Weil withdrew the cadmium rod. Fermi nodded, and Zip was winched out as well. "This is going to do it," Fermi told Compton. The director of the plutonium project had found a place for himself at Fermi's side. "Now it will become self-sustaining. The trace on the recorder will climb and continue to climb. It will not level off." Herbert Anderson was an eyewitness. At first you could hear the sound of the neutron counter, clickety-clack, clickety-clack. Then the clicks came more and more rapidly, and after a while they began to merge into a roar. The counter couldn't follow anymore. That was the moment to switch to the chart recorder. But when the switch was made, everyone watched in the sudden silence the mounting deflection of the recorder's pen. It was an awesome silence. Everyone realized the significance of that switch. We were in the high-intensity regime, and the counters were unable to cope with the situation anymore. Again and again, the scale of the recorder had to be changed to accommodate the neutron intensity, which was increasing more and more rapidly. Suddenly, Fermi raised his hand. "The pile has gone critical," he announced. No one present had any doubt about it. Fermi allowed himself a grin. He would tell the technical council the next day that the pile achieved a K of 1.0006. Its neutron intensity was then doubling every 2 minutes. Left uncontrolled for an hour and a half, that rate of increase would have carried it to 1,000,000 kilowatts. Long before so extreme a runaway, it would have killed anyone left in the room and melted down. "Then everyone began to wonder why he didn't shut the pile off," Anderson continues. But Fermi was completely calm. He waited another minute, then another, and when it seemed that the anxiety was too much to bear, he ordered, "Zip in!" It was 3:53 p.m. Fermi had run the pile for 4.5 minutes at 1/2 watt and brought to fruition all the years of discovery and experiment. Men had controlled the release of energy from the atomic nucleus. The chain reaction was moonshine no more. Eugene Wigner reports how they felt. Nothing very spectacular had happened. Nothing had moved, and the pile itself had given no sound. Nevertheless, when the rods were pushed back in and the clicking died down, we suddenly experienced a let-down feeling, for all of us understood the language of the counter. Even though we had anticipated the success of the experiment, its accomplishment had a deep impact on us. For some time, we had known that we were about to unlock a giant. Still, we could not escape an eerie feeling when we knew we had actually done it. We felt, as I presume everyone feels, who has done something that he knows will have very far-reaching consequences, which he cannot foresee. Months earlier, realizing that the importation of Italian wine had been cut off by the war, Wigner had searched the liquor stores of Chicago for a celebratory fiasco of Chianti. He produced it now in a brown paper bag and presented it to Fermi. "We each had a small amount in a paper cup," Wattenberg says, "and drank silently, looking at Fermi. Someone told Fermi to sign the straw wrapping on the bottle. After he did so, he passed it around and we all signed it, except Wigner." Compton and Greenwalt took their leave as Wilson began shutting down the electronics. Seaborg bumped into the DuPont engineer in the corridor of Eckert Hall and found him bursting with good news. Back in his office, Compton called Conant, who was working in Washington, in my quarters in the dormitory attached to the Dumbarton Oaks Library and collection of Harvard University. Compton records their improvised dialogue. "Jim," I said, "you'll be interested to know that the Italian navigator has just landed in the New World." Then, half apologetically, because I had led the S1 committee to believe that it would be another week or more before the pile could be completed, I added, "The Earth was not as large as he had estimated, and he arrived at the New World sooner than he had expected." "Is that so?" was Conant's excited response. "Were the natives friendly?" "Everyone landed safe and happy. Except Leo Szilard. Szilard, who was responsible with Fermi for the accomplishment that chill December afternoon of what he had first imagined alone on a gray September morning in another country an age ago, the old world undone by the new, loitered on the balcony, a small round man in an overcoat. He had dreamed that atomic energy might substitute exploration for war, carrying men away from the narrow Earth into the cosmos. He knew now that long before it propelled any such exodus, it would increase war's devastation and mire man deeper in fear. He blinked behind his glasses. It was the end of the beginning. It might well be the beginning of the end. There was a crowd there, and then Fermi and I stayed there alone. I shook hands with Fermi, and I said I thought this day would go down as a black day in the history of mankind. 14. Physics and Desert Country. Robert Oppenheimer was 38 years old in 1942. He had done by then what Hans Bethe calls massive scientific work. He was known and respected as a theoretician throughout the world of physics. Up to the time of the Berkeley summer study, however, few of his peers seem to have thought him capable of decisive leadership. Though he had matured deeply across the decade of the 1930s, his persistent mannerisms, especially his caustic tongue, may have screened his maturity from his colleagues' eyes. Yet the 1930s shaped Oppenheimer for the work that was now to challenge him. His distinctive appearance sharpens the memory of an admiring new friend of that decade, a Berkeley professor and translator of French literature named Hakon Chevalier. Oppenheimer was tall, nervous, and intent, and he moved with an odd gait, a kind of jog, with a great deal of swinging of his limbs, his head always a little to one side, one shoulder higher than the other. But it was the head that was the most striking, the halo of wispy, black, curly hair, the fine, sharp nose, and especially the eyes, surprisingly blue, having a strange depth and intensity, and yet expressive of a candor that was altogether disarming. He looked like a young Einstein, and at the same time, like an overgrown choir boy. Chevalier's portrait identifies Oppenheimer's youthfulness and sensitivity, but misses the self-destructiveness, the chain-smoking, the persistent cough persistently ignored, the ravaged teeth, the usually empty stomach assaulted by highly praised martinis and highly spiced food. Oppenheimer's emaciation suggests he had an aversion to incorporating the world. His body embarrassed him, and he seldom allowed himself to appear, as at the beach, undressed. At school, he wore gray suits, blue shirts, and well-polished black shoes. At home, a small, spare apartment at first. Later, after his marriage, the elegant house in the Berkeley Hills he bought with a check the day he first toured it. He preferred jeans and blue chambray work shirts. The jeans hung on his narrow hips with a wide Western silver buckled belt. It was not a common look in the 1930s. He had picked it up in New Mexico, and it was another detail that made him seem different. Women thought him handsome and dashing. Before a party, he might send gardenias not only to his own date, but to his friends' dates as well. He was great at a party, a female acquaintance of his later adulthood comments, and women simply loved him. His unfailing attentiveness probably elicited that admiration. He was always, writes Chevalier, without seeming effort, aware of and responsive to everyone in the room, and was constantly anticipating unspoken wishes. Men, he could antagonize or amuse. Edward Teller first met Oppenheimer in 1937. The meeting, Teller says, was painful but characteristic. On the evening I was to talk at a Berkeley colloquium, he took me out to a Mexican restaurant for dinner. I didn't have the practice in speaking that I've had since, and I was already a little nervous. The plates were so hot, and the spices were so hot, as you might expect if you knew Oppenheimer, and his personality was so overpowering that I lost my voice. Emilio Segre notes that Oppenheimer sometimes appeared amateurish and snobbish. Out of curiosity, in 1940, while visiting Berkeley to deliver a lecture, Enrico Fermi attended a seminar one of Oppenheimer's protégés led in the master's style. "Emilio," Fermi joked afterward with Segre, "I am getting rusty and old. I cannot follow the highbrow theory developed by Oppenheimer's pupils anymore. I went to their seminar and was depressed by my inability to understand them. Only the last sentence cheered me up. It was, 'And this is Fermi's theory of beta decay.'" Although Segre found Oppenheimer the fastest thinker I've ever met, with an iron memory, brilliance, and solid merits, he also saw grave defects, including occasional arrogance, that stung scientific colleagues where they were most sensitive. "Robert could make people feel they were fools," Bethe says, simply. "He made me, but I didn't mind." Lawrence did. The two disagreed while they were both still at Berkeley. "I think Robert would give Lawrence a feeling that he didn't know physics, and since that is what cyclotrons are for, Lawrence didn't like it." Oppenheimer recognized the habit without diagnosing it in a letter to his younger brother Frank. "But it is not easy, at least it is not easy for me, to be quite free of the desire to browbeat somebody or something." He called the behavior beastliness. It did not win him friends. Oppenheimer's mother died after a long battle with leukemia in late 1931. That was when he announced himself to Herbert Smith, his former ethical culture teacher, to be the loneliest man in the world. His father died suddenly of a heart attack in 1937. The two deaths frame the beginning years of the unworldly physicist's discovery of the suffering in the world. Later, he testified to the surprise of that discovery. "My friends, both in Pasadena and in Berkeley, were mostly faculty people, scientists, classicists, and artists. I studied and read Sanskrit with Arthur Ryder. I read very widely, mostly classics, novels, plays, and poetry. I read something of other parts of science. I was not interested in and did not read about economics or politics. I was almost wholly divorced from the contemporary scene in this country. I never read a newspaper or a current magazine like Time or Harper's. I had no radio, no telephone. I learned of the stock market crash in the fall of 1929, only long after the event. The first time I ever voted was in the presidential election of 1936. To many of my friends, my indifference to contemporary affairs seemed bizarre, and they often chided me with being too much of a highbrow. I was interested in man and his experience. I was deeply interested in science. But I had no understanding of the relations of man to his society." Beginning in late 1936, my interest began to change. Oppenheimer reports three reasons for the change. "I had a continuing, smoldering fury about the treatment of the Jews in Germany," he mentions first. "I had relatives there, and was later to help in extricating them and bringing them to this country. They arrived only a few days after his father's death, and he and Frank volunteered responsibility for them. Second," says Oppenheimer, "I saw what the Depression was doing to my students. Philip Morrison, one of the wittiest of the young theoreticians, polio-crippled and poor, remembers in compensation the very grave, very profound involvement in physics, the love of the whole thing, which we all had in those days." Oppenheimer could take his admiring students to dinner. He was unable to find them jobs. "And through them," he testifies, "I began to understand how deeply political and economic events could affect men's lives. I began to feel the need to participate more fully in the life of the community." He had no framework yet. A woman would help him with that. Her involvement, the third reason he gives for his entry into the world. Jean Tadlock, the lithe, chiaroscuro daughter of an anti-Semite Berkeley medievalist. "In the summer of 1936, I began to court her, and we grew close to each other. We were at least twice close enough to marriage to think of ourselves as engaged. Tadlock was bright, passionate, and compassionate, frequently depressed. Their relationship was an ocean of storms. But so were Tadlock's other commitments. She told me about her Communist Party memberships. They were on-again, off-again affairs, and never seemed to provide her what she was seeking. The couple began to move together among what he calls left-wing friends. I liked the new sense of companionship, and at the time felt that I was coming to be part of the life of my time and country. He was taken with the causes of the Loyalists in the Spanish Civil War and the migrant workers in California, to both of which he contributed time and money. He read Engels and Feuerbach and all of Marx, finding their dialectics less rigorous than his taste. I never accepted communist dogma or theory. In fact, it never made sense to me." He met his wife, Kitty, in the summer of 1939 in Pasadena. She was petite and dark, with a broad, high forehead, brown eyes, prominent cheekbones, and a wide, expressive mouth. On the rebound, she had married a young British physician, Dr. Stuart Harrison, who was a friend and associate of the Richard Tolmans, Charles C. Lauritsens, and others of the California Institute of Technology faculty. Harrison was doing cancer research. I learned of her earlier marriage to Joe Dallet and of his death fighting in Spain. He had been a Communist Party official, and for a year or two during their brief marriage, my wife was a Communist Party member. When I met her, I found in her a deep loyalty to her former husband, a complete disengagement from any political activity, and a certain disappointment and contempt that the Communist Party was not, in fact, what she had once thought it was. The involvement was apparently immediate and intense. Probably with his wife's encouragement, but certainly with his own growing good sense, Oppenheimer began to jettison political commitments that had come to seem parochial. "I went to a big Spanish relief party the night before Pearl Harbor," he testifies, an example. "And the next day, as we heard the news of the outbreak of war, I decided that I had had about enough of the Spanish cause, and that there were other and more pressing crises in the world." He was willing, similarly, to abandon the American Association of Scientific Workers at Lawrence's insistence in order to help, as he supposed, to beat the Nazis to the atomic bomb. "By then," says Bethe, though Oppenheimer had been a poor teacher when he began, pitching quantum theory well above his students' untrained range, "he had created the greatest school of theoretical physics that the United States has ever known." Bethe's explanation for that evolution reveals the seedbed of Oppenheimer's later administrative leadership. Probably the most important ingredient he brought to his teaching was his exquisite taste. He always knew what were the important problems, as shown by his choice of subjects. He truly lived with those problems, struggling for a solution, and he communicated his concern to his group. He was interested in everything. And in one afternoon, he and his students might discuss quantum electrodynamics, cosmic rays, electron pair production, and nuclear physics. During the same period, Oppenheimer's clumsiness with experiment evolved to appreciation, and he consciously mastered experimental work, hands off. He began to observe, not manipulate, a former student notes. He learned to see the apparatus and to get a feeling of its experimental limitations. He grasped the underlying physics and had the best memory I know of. He could always see how far any particular experiment would go. When you couldn't carry it any farther, you could count on him to understand and to be thinking about the next thing you might want to try. It remained for Oppenheimer to learn to control his beastliness and submerge his mannerisms. But he was always a quick study. Significantly, he was least convoluted, most direct, least mannered, most natural, living simply at his unadorned ranch in the Picos Valley, high in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains of northern New Mexico. Oppenheimer first met General Leslie R. Groves when Groves came to Berkeley from Chicago on his initial inspection tour in early October 1942. They attended a luncheon given by the president of the university. Afterward, they talked. Oppenheimer had already discussed the need for a fast neutron laboratory at the Met Lab Technical Council meeting on September 29th. He envisioned more responsibilities for that laboratory than basic fission studies, as he testified after the war. "I became convinced, as did others, that a major change was called for in the work on the bomb itself. We needed a central laboratory devoted wholly to this purpose, where people could talk freely with each other, where theoretical ideas and experimental findings could affect each other, where the waste and frustration and error of the many compartmentalized experimental studies could be eliminated, where we could begin to come to grips with chemical, metallurgical, engineering, and ordnance problems that had so far received no consideration." Memory compresses the laboratory's evolution here, however. Oppenheimer is not likely to have discussed eliminating Groves's cherished compartmentalization at their first meeting. To the contrary, he goes on to say, the two men first considered making the laboratory a military establishment in which key personnel would be commissioned as officers, and he carried the idea far enough before he left Berkeley to visit a nearby military post to begin the process of commissioning. Groves remembers that his original impression gained from our first conversation in Berkeley was that a central laboratory was a good idea. He felt strongly that The work of bomb design should be started at once in order that one part of our operation, at any rate, could progress at what I hoped would be a comfortable pace. His immediate concern was leadership. He believed that the right man at the helm could sail even the most ungovernable boat. Ernest Lawrence would have been Groves's first choice, but the general doubted if anyone else could make electromagnetic isotope separation work. Compton had his hands full in Chicago. Harold Urey was a chemist. Outside the project, there may have been other suitable people, but they were all fully occupied on essential work, and none of those suggested appeared to be the equal of Oppenheimer. Groves had already sized up his man. It was not obvious that Oppenheimer would be the new laboratory's director, Bethent notes. He had, after all, no experience in directing a large group of people. The laboratory would be devoted primarily to experiment and to engineering, and Oppenheimer was a theorist. Worse, in the eyes of the project leaders, Nobel laureates all, he had no Nobel Prize to distinguish him. There was also what Groves calls the snag of Oppenheimer's left-wing background, which included much that was not to our liking by any means. Groves had not yet wrested control of Manhattan Project Security from Army Counterintelligence, and that organization adamantly refused to clear someone whose former fiancé, wife, brother, and sister-in-law had all been members of the Communist Party once, and perhaps, gone underground, still were. The general wanted Oppenheimer anyway. "He's a genius," Groves told an interviewer off the record immediately after the war. "A real genius. While Lawrence is very bright, he's not a genius. Just a good, hard worker. Why, Oppenheimer knows about everything. He can talk to you about anything you bring up. Well, not exactly. I guess there are a few things he doesn't know about. He doesn't know anything about sports." Groves proposed Oppenheimer's name to the Military Policy Committee. It balked. After much discussion, I asked each member to give me the name of a man who would be a better choice. In a few weeks, it became apparent that we were not going to find a better man. So Oppenheimer was asked to undertake the task. The physicist demurred later that he was chosen by default. The truth is that the obvious people were already taken and that the project had a bad name. Robbie would come to think that it was a real stroke of genius on the part of General Groves, who was not generally considered to be a genius, to have appointed him. But at the time it seemed a most improbable appointment. I was astonished. Groves, on his way from Chicago to New York, asked Oppenheimer on October 15, 1942, to ride on the train with him as far as Detroit to discuss the appointment. The two men met with Vannevar Bush in Washington on October 19th. That long meeting was apparently decisive. Security questions would have to wait. The next problem was where to locate the new laboratory. Already at his first meeting with Oppenheimer in Berkeley, Groves had stressed the need for isolation. However much or little the scientists who gathered at the new center would be allowed to talk to each other, the general intended to divide them away from the populace. For this reason, Oppenheimer wrote his Illinois colleague, John H. Manley, in mid-October, "Some rather far-reaching geographical change in plans seems to be in the cards." In the same letter, Oppenheimer proposed starting now on a policy of absolutely unscrupulous recruiting of anyone we can lay hands on. He wanted the best he could get, and soon asked Groves for the likes of Bethe, Segre, Serber, and Teller. Site Y, as the hypothetical laboratory was initially called, needed good transportation, an adequate supply of water, a local labor force, and a moderate climate for year-round construction and for experiment conducted outdoors. In his memoirs, Groves lists safety as the primary reason he insisted on isolation, so that nearby communities would not be adversely affected by any unforeseen results from our activities. But the high steel fence topped with triple strands of barbed wire that eventually surrounded the laboratory was clearly not designed to confine explosions. Groves was in the midst of selecting sites for Manhattan Project production centers. The difference between his criteria for those locations and his criteria for Site Y, was that at the bomb design laboratory, we were faced with the necessity of importing a group of highly talented specialists, some of whom would be prima donnas, and of keeping them satisfied with their working and living conditions. If that, in fact, was Groves's intention, it was one of the few wartime goals he failed to achieve. The general assigned the task of identifying a suitable location for the laboratory to Major John H. Dudley of the Manhattan Engineer District. Groves gave Dudley criteria more specific than satisfying prima donnas. Room for 265 people. Location at least 200 miles from any international boundary, but west of the Mississippi. Some existing facilities, a natural bowl with the hills nearby that shaped the bowl so that fences might be strung on top and guarded. Traveling by air, rail, auto, jeep, and horse through most of the American Southwest, Dudley found the perfect place, Oak City, Utah, a delightful little oasis in south-central Utah. But to claim it, the Army would have had to evict several dozen families and remove a large area of farmland from production. Dudley thereupon recommended his second choice, Jemez Springs, New Mexico, a deep canyon about 40 miles northwest of Santa Fe on the western slope of the Jemez Mountains. A lovely spot, Oppenheimer thought in early November before he toured it, and in every way satisfactory. When the newly appointed director arrived on November 16th to inspect the Jemez Springs location with Dudley and Edwin McMillan, who was helping start the laboratory, he changed his mind. The canyon felt confining. Oppenheimer knew the region's grand scenic vistas and decided he wanted a laboratory with a view. McMillan also remembers expressing considerable reservations about this site. We were arguing with Dudley when General Groves showed up. This had been planned. He would come in sometimes in the afternoon and receive our report. As soon as Groves saw the site, he didn't like it. He said, "This'll never do." At that point, Oppenheimer spoke up and said, "If you go up the canyon, you come out on top of the mesa, and there's a boys' school there, which might be a usable site." Oppenheimer proposed the boys' school site, grouses Dudley, as though it was a brand new idea. Dudley had already scouted the mesa twice, rejecting it because it failed to meet Groves's criteria. But a mesa is an inverted bowl, its perimeter similarly fenceable, and the first requirement was to make the Longhairs happy. "As I knew the roads or trails," Dudley says sardonically, "we drove directly there." The school was called Los Alamos, the daughter of its founder writes, after the deep canyon which bordered the mesa to the south, and which was groved with cottonwood trees along the sandy trickle of its stream. Ashley Pond, the founder, had been a sickly boarding school boy sent west for his health, like Oppenheimer, who returned to New Mexico in later adulthood when his father died and left him with independent means. He opened the Los Alamos Ranch School on the 7,200-foot mesa in 1917. It was organized to invigorate pale scions, as Pond had been invigorated. Boys slept on unheated porches of a chinked log dormitory and wore shorts in winter snow. Each was assigned a horse to ride and groom. It was, Emilio Segre writes, beautiful and savage country. The dark Jemez Mountains to the west that formed the higher rim of the Jemez Caldera, the slumped cone of the old volcano of which Los Alamos was eroded to facious spill. Precipitously down from the mesa eastward, the valley of the Rio Grande, hot and barren except for the green meander of the river, writes Laura Fermi, with sand, cacti, a few pinon trees hardly rising above the ground, and space, immense, transparent, with no fog or moisture. Further east, the wall of the Rocky Mountains, as that range extends south into New Mexico,